This morning we're in Botany, an historical suburb of Sydney. Just near here is the first landing site where James Cook came ashore in 1770. But the reason we're here today is a legacy of a different kind, an industrial legacy of pollution.
Yeah, so there's been industrial activity in this area, Meadowbank, Botany, for probably about 100 years, formerly a munitions site apparently, and ICI, Chemical Manufacturing Company, have been active on this site since the 1940s, I think, and rebranded ultimately in the 90s as Orica Australia. But there's been a lot of heavy industry on this site for a long period of time, and that stretches back long before there was legislation and an environmental movement in the community to look after the land and to recognise that pollution was a bad thing and that space on the planet was limited. And so the land that we're standing on is above groundwater and aquifer, the Botany Sands aquifer, which is heavily polluted with chlorinated compounds like chloroform and dichloroethane, which have a very negative impact on the environment and on human health. And a lot of efforts going into cleaning up this aquifer, and our work on the biology of the microbes that live in the aquifer is helping break down the pollutants in the ground such that we can use the groundwater again for recreation and for watering gardens and whatnot.
That's Associate Professor Mike Mainfield, an Australian Research Council Future Fellow from the School of Biotechnology and Biomolecular Sciences at the University of New South Wales. Mike and I are here at Botany Industrial Park, and at first glance, there's nothing to indicate that where we're standing is one of the most polluted sites in Australia. There's patches of shrubbery and clumps of native bush, reeds lining the banks of a small stream running through the site, and all appear to be thriving. But just under the surface, the groundwater is contaminated with a heady mix of hazardous industrial toxins. I'm Joel Werner, and you're listening to Off Track here on RN. And the good news is that Mike and his team have developed a cheap and effective way to clean up the pollution by taking advantage of an organism that's been living here all along.
On the Botany Industrial Park, there have been spills, accidental spills over time of chlorinated solvents, and they leak down into the groundwater, and they're not soluble in water. They're heavier than water. They sort of sink to the bedrock, and then as the groundwater washes over them, the compounds are solubilized, and you end up with a big sort of soluble plume of the contaminants that go in the direction of the groundwater. So Botany Industrial Park over there, groundwater moving this way towards Botany Bay, Penrhyn Estuary, and all the groundwater underneath our feet is contaminated with chloroform and dichloroethane.
Which, obviously, is a bad thing.
Yeah, not good for you. They are very useful compounds for degreasing engines and cleaning clothes and the like, and producing refrigerants, but once they're in the environment, all their properties of persistence become real problems in terms of recalcitrance in the environment. And big doses will ruin your liver, and small doses will give you cancer. You don't want it getting into Penrhyn Estuary, into Botany Bay. People are using that water for recreation and fishing and whatnot. But you also don't want to be filling up your swimming pools with that water. There's a lot of private bores in this area. There's a ban on using water from those bores because of the contamination. And Orica have put in place three containment lines, one down on Foreshore Road, one just here, and one up here next to the park, to pull the groundwater out, pump it to a treatment system on the Botany Industrial Park and clean it up that way, and then it's released back into the environment. So they have containment systems in place to stop it getting to Botany Bay, and they have a ban on the use of bore water in this area.
When they go to treat it, once they've taken it out and are treating it at their plant, what process are they using to treat the water over there?
So that is a steam stripping and a chemical oxidation, I believe. It's not my area of expertise, but it's a very energy-intensive process, a massive infrastructure. It cost a fortune to set up all of the pumping systems, all the monitoring systems, and the plant itself. And it's projected to run for hundreds of years because the solubility of the compounds in the environment is so low that you have this sort of non-dissolved stuff sitting there, and it will take 100, 200 years for that all to dissolve, be picked up by the containment lines and taken to the treatment plant. So, yeah. That's the status quo. And what we're trying to do is get the bugs in the ground to be happy enough to eat that stuff so that they don't have to keep doing that for 200 years, save on energy and save on the finances that drive that.
So tell us about these bugs. Tell us about the bacteria that you found that are not only speeding up the process, but are cheaper and natural.
Yeah, so they're an unusual breed. We give them fancy names like Dahalococcoides and Dahalobacter, the sulfatobacterium, and Dahalogenomonas. These are the main genera that can breathe these compounds. So the bacteria aren't eating these compounds, they're actually using them as an electron acceptor in the same way that we use oxygen to generate energy. And they're fairly rare in the environment generally, but if you get these chlorinated compounds into the groundwater and everything else is okay for the bugs, then they'll start breathing them, and the populations will become larger until the pollution's gone, and then they'll sort of die away again because they'll effectively suffocate.
The bacteria that you're using in this process are naturally occurring here. They weren't something that you discovered in the lab and brought here. They're actually a naturally occurring local bacteria.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, the types of organisms that can do this are present all over the planet. So you can find them pretty much anywhere. But because of the pollution here, it's been a wonderful breeding ground for this type of bacteria. So we're finding all sorts of interesting bugs from this site. And we're bringing them into the lab and culturing them up and getting rid of the redundancy in the community. So you get a whole complex array of different organisms out of a groundwater sample. We'll take that back to the lab and we will enrich for the organisms that perform the function or the process that we're interested in getting done, which is the breakdown of the pollutants. We add those to their media and force the community to grow on those, and so only the ones that can do that sort of end up left. And so we can enrich for them, get a high concentration of them, bring them back on site and inoculate an area to really speed the process up.
So tell me about that process of inoculation. What are you doing? How do you actually get the bacteria into the contaminated ground?
Yep, so you can see the wells around here. So again, the groundwater flowing this way, we've got a well where we inject, and we've got wells to the side, sort of laterally to that, one upstream or up gradient, and then all these wells going down gradient to monitor the process of, you know, where the bacteria are going and what they're doing. So we can sample from all of these wells. We use a peristaltic pump just to bring groundwater samples up, put them in bottles and take them back to the lab to analyze them for the microbes and for the chemistry of what's going on. We bring the bugs on site in beer kegs, and we attach the beer kegs with a peristaltic pump into the wells that go into the groundwater. Switch the pumps on and just transfer culture straight down into the groundwater. The groundwater flow helps mix those in, but it's another really interesting aspect of it. You know, do the bugs stay where you put them, or do they move with the groundwater? Because generally microbes enjoy attaching to surfaces living in biofilms. So, you know, a lot of them stay in a single point. Some of them float off with the groundwater in the direction of the plume, and the ones that are sort of staying put, they act as a seed bank for inoculating the groundwater over a long period of time. And we've found that the culture that we put in here, without feeding it, without giving it any food source, it stuck around for at least a year. Which we thought was pretty impressive.
And how effective are the bugs at actually cleaning up the contaminant?
They're very good. So it does occur quite rapidly when you get the numbers up enough, when you get the conditions right. So one of the challenges on this site has been the low pH, but we trained the bugs to cope with the low pH. So they were able to operate fairly rapidly, and with the dichloroethane, which was what we were targeting here, the organism that we had, which was a disulfatobacterium, was capable of a reaction called a dihaloelimination reaction, which removes the two chlorine atoms from dichloroethane simultaneously to produce ethene, which is an innocuous gas. We use it to ripen tomatoes and that kind of thing. So that's a very desirable end product. And the nice thing about it just being a single step reaction is that you have no breakdown intermediates that might also be toxic. And that's one thing we have to really keep an eye on with the biology, because there are other pollutants like perchloroethane which go through a sequential step-by-step process, and one of the breakdown intermediates is a compound called vinyl chloride, which is nastier than the parent compound. So if you don't get it to go all the way, then you've made the problem worse. And so that's stuff that we have to be really careful about.
I guess an obvious question that you might have touched on before when you're talking about breeding out the redundancies in the bacteria in the lab, if these are naturally occurring bacteria, then why haven't they been doing the job that they're doing naturally here? Why do you need to reintroduce the species?
So it's a competition thing. So as food, as a source of carbon and energy for these organisms, there's a lot of organic material sort of leaching out from peat lenses and whatnot in the aquifer. and there's a lot of competition for those nutrients, for the carbon, for the energy. So you get organisms like sulfate-reducing bacteria, you get methanogenic archaea, all these tiny little organisms that have different ways of making a living. And what we want to do is shift the competition, basically cheat, or give the organochlorine-respiring bacteria, the ones that break down the pollutants, an unfair advantage, such that the energy that's available in the groundwater goes to that process rather than to other processes that we're not that interested in pursuing, like the sulfate reduction or the production of methane.
And where to next? I mean, what's the next step in actually... are you going to be introducing these bacteria in a more broad scale down here?
Yeah, so we've been using organisms from the Botany Industrial Park to inoculate other polluted sites around the country. So we've been working down in Victoria with the Altona Chemical Complex and Deer Park in Melbourne, where they've got similar contamination problems. But on the Botany Industrial Park, we've more recently discovered a chloroform-degrading culture. And one of the main contaminants in this groundwater is chloroform. It's a really nasty one because that knocks out the microbiology, that knocks out all the organisms that are capable of breaking down the other pollutants that are in the groundwater. So the priority here is actually to remove the chloroform from the groundwater. And we've recently discovered the world's first complete chloroform-degrading bacteria. So we are planning, so we're doing some trials in the lab in columns packed with sand, similar sort of matrix to what this aquifer is here. And we are planning to put that culture back on site where the chloroform concentrations are really high. And the intention there is to create a clean shadow inside the polluted plume, such that we can convince Orica that they don't need to pump from that particular area anymore, to demonstrate that the bugs can actually do the job of this massive containment and groundwater treatment system that they've got in place.
And do it a lot cheaper and more effectively.
Yeah, that's right. Without the energy costs, you know, we might have to supply food in the form of acetate or lactate or emulsified vegetable oil or ethanol, the different things that we feed the bacteria. But that will be the only ongoing cost. And once the bacteria sort of get a foothold on site, then they can start chewing sort of back towards the source of the contamination, such that you can turn off this whole containment facility. Yeah, lower cost, lower energy use, and really just exploiting the planet's natural ability to clean itself.
Associate Professor Mike Mainfield and the bacteria that literally breathe away industrial pollution. To find out more about Mike's work, go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off Track, which is where you are now. I'm Joel Werner. Do you know what a slime mold is? Chances are, if you walked outside right now, you'd be able to find one without too much trouble. What you might not realise is that these brainless, single-celled organisms are capable of quite complex spatial problem-solving. If you have trouble reading a map, then this slime might have your number. PhD candidate Chris Reed studies these fantastic organisms, and when I visit his lab at the University of Sydney's School of Biological Sciences, he has one ready to introduce to me. It's a sprawling, gooey, yellow film slowly spilling over the sides of its container.
It's basically one large yellow blob, and that blob can grow to a couple of square metres in area, but that whole organism is just one big cell. And it can move around the environment like an amoeba, sort of engulfing things that it eats and exploring its environment by just projecting itself forward in lots of different directions. And it's a very alien kind of creature.
It sounds like something from a science fiction novel. Can you tell us about the life cycle of the organism?
Absolutely. It's got a very strange life cycle from our perspective. Spores, which are released into the environment, will hatch, and out of those spores will come a single-celled microscopic cell with a tail that swims. So it will swim through the environment and it'll eat yeast and bacteria. And when it meets up with another cell of the same kind, they'll fuse just like when a sperm cell meets an egg cell. And then that will become the part of the life cycle that I work with, which is called a plasmodium. So that cell then divides nuclei, but the cell itself doesn't actually divide, it just grows in size. And so we end up with one really big cell, and that's the yellow slime mold that we're familiar with. When that slime mold comes across a dry environment or somewhere that it doesn't actually like to be, it can really escape that place by releasing spores, which then continue the life cycle elsewhere, hopefully in somewhere a bit darker and more humid that the slime mold likes.
Where do you find these? What's its natural habitat?
The slime molds are found pretty much everywhere in the world. They're widespread, always moving around in the leaf litter, in the undergrowth, dark areas mostly, and woody vegetation. Often you can find them in your backyards if it's the right time of year. They're just not very often noticed by people walking around. So next time you're out in the great outdoors, just have a closer look at that rotting log and you'll probably see a little mucusy pile of goo, and that'll be our friend the slime mold.
Now, the way that the slime mold travels around the environment is essential to the work that you've been doing. Can you tell us about this experiment that you've run?
So we work with behavioural experiments in the slime mold, so looking at how unicellular organism can solve problems. In the course of our experiments, we noticed that the slime mold tended to avoid areas it had already explored. And you can tell where the slime mold's explored because it leaves behind it a trail of what we call extracellular slime. And this slime is actually what the slime molds were named after. We thought that maybe the slime mold was leaving behind this trail to remind itself in the future of where it had been before. And in that way, it can more efficiently explore its environment by not going over places it's already been and find food in a more efficient manner. So we thought we'd better figure out a way to actually definitively test this. And we ended up somehow looking through the literature on autonomous robotics, as you do. And we came across a really neat test called the U-shaped trap test. Now, this trap is designed to test how well robots can navigate by themselves when they haven't been programmed with a map or map-making abilities, and they only react to what's in their immediate environment. What can often happen is if you place an obstacle between these robots and the goal they're programmed to go towards, they can easily become stuck. If you program in them a really basic memory, which just says to the robot, avoid areas you've been in the recent past, that's enough to give them the ability to escape these traps and to navigate much more effectively. So we thought maybe the slime mold's doing a similar thing and leaving behind this trail, which tells it to avoid areas it had been in the recent past. And so it should be able to solve these problems just like the robots do. So we designed a little experiment and put the slime mold in the robot chest, and away we went.
So your obstacle was a U-shaped barrier. And what was the goal that the slime mold was trying to reach?
The slime mold was placed onto an agar surface, which is just a jelly, which keeps the slime mold nice and moist. We drilled a hole into that jelly and placed some sugar water. And the sugar water then diffuses throughout the jelly, building a gradient that the slime mold can move along as it navigates towards the source of the sugar to feed on it. The way we trap the slime mold is to just put a simple acetate sheet in the shape of a U, so an overhead projector sheet, really. This is enough to stop the slime mold from moving over it because it's a dry environment, so it tends to shy away from these environments. So we can trap the slime mold within this U, and if the slime mold wants to reach that sugar solution, it's got to then travel back out of the U, which means travelling against that gradient of sugar. So if the slime mold's just moving along a gradient like most unicellular organisms do, it's going to get stuck in that trap and never get out. It needs to have some more sophisticated mechanism to remember where it's been in order to get out of the trap. And that's exactly what we saw.
So what did you find? Tell us the results.
We found that when we ran the trap experiment on a blank surface, so the jelly is clean, the slime mold can lay down its own trail as a memory system, that the trap didn't really phase the slime mold at all. It would move straight into the trap as it moves along that gradient of sugar, but as soon as it hit the wall, it would quickly find its way back out and around the trap and straight towards the sugar. What we needed to do was to find a way to knock out that memory system to definitively show that that's what the slime mold uses to navigate. And the way we did that was to coat the entire jelly surface with extracellular slime from the slime mold. That way it can't recognize the trails it lays down itself, and so the memory system has been knocked out. When we ran those experiments, only a third of the slime molds managed to solve the problem, where before it was 96%. And the slime molds that did solve the problem when the memory system was erased took about 30% longer to solve the problem. They traveled a much longer route as well and spent 10 times more time looking over areas that they'd been before in the past. So it really affects the navigation system if you knock out this memory system.
Now, this is the first time that spatial memory has been shown in a unicellular organism.
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of people have tried in the past to show memory systems in unicellular organisms. Often they can be trained or in some other way conditioned to stimuli, but we didn't have to do any of that with our slime mold. This is something the slime mold does on its own in nature, and it's the first time that any kind of spatial memory system has been shown in a unicellular organism, and definitely in an organism without a brain, because we often think of memory and we think of our own memory system, which is neuronal. But there can be a lot of other memory systems out there, and we're just discovering them now.
It's interesting, when I was reading your paper, I noticed that you placed memory in inverted commas in the title of the paper. Was that because there are issues around defining memory and whether this counts as a bona fide memory or not?
I don't think there are issues around it. Often when you invoke the word memory, it brings up in people's minds the brain definition, the psychologist definition of human memory. The definition of memory we use is a bit broader than that, which is just information that relates to past events that can be recalled in the future. So as the slime mold lays down the slime, it's storing that information about where it's been in the external environment rather than storing it between synapses and neurons as we would. And it can recall that information later when it touches that slime in the future and then react to it by moving to a different area to explore. So in that way, it's a similar definition of memory as you would for shape, memory, metal, or acrylics that can be heated and snap back into the shape that they had memorized. So that's the definition that we went for.
And as you mentioned in the paper, similar types of memory are used by more complex organisms like honeybees, who might leave a trace of where they've been collecting nectar so they don't over-harvest the one flower.
That's right. This is what ecologists call patch marking. It's a commonly used strategy for foraging more efficiently. So not exploring areas that you've already been and taken all the food from, you can then quickly recognise them and move on to somewhere else to be more efficient. That's similar to what the slime mold's doing here, except we showed that the slime mold uses that kind of system in a navigational sense, so to aid its navigation in tricky and complex environments.
So how does a unicellular organism achieve such complex behaviour?
So different parts of the slime mold are constantly pulsating. And they pulsate at a certain frequency. That frequency is determined by whether there's food in the environment or whether there's light or heat or something the slime mold wants to move towards or away from. The pulsation frequency is what drives the locomotion of the organism. But what's really interesting is that neighbouring parts of the cell are influenced to vibrate at the frequency of other parts of the cell. So in that way, the information about what's in the environment can be quickly transferred throughout the whole cell, even if it's spanning several metres across. And the whole cell can then act as a coordinated unit. And that's what gives the slime mold such intelligent properties.
Such complex behaviour from such a simple organism. Is there anything to suggest that this could have been one of the early precursors to more complex organisms?
We certainly think that the slime mold moves and behaves and really lives like primitive cells did, even before multicellularity came along. So we think the slime mold solves similar problems to what those ancient cells did and does so in similar ways. So what we're saying is that this memory system that we've discovered could be a functional precursor to human memory. Not necessarily an evolutionary precursor, because we don't necessarily think that slime molds and humans share a common line of descent. But certainly our ancestors, and we're talking way back in the distant evolutionary past, would have had to solve similar problems. And we think that when unicellular organisms were solving these problems, they did so by externalizing information in the environment and then reacting to that information later on. So that theory has been around for a little while, but no one's ever come up with a way of testing it or really showing any evidence for it. So we think we're the first ones to do that.
PhD candidate Chris Reid from the University of Sydney's School of Biological Sciences. And that's all there is for this week's show. Thanks for listening. And until next time, bye for now.